So we're here for Becoming a CEO, Lessons from Four Tech Ed Leaders. I'm going to let the amazing women on this panel introduce themselves, starting with Meredith Finn Ripley from Haywire.
Hi, guys. Thank you for braving the morning. So I'm the CEO of Media Friends, which is the company that launched Haywire, the world's largest free texting service, a highly rated app in Apple and Android stores. And we're here giving sneak peeks on our new app, which is Bandwagon. I've spent half of my career now, I'm at that tipping point, as a CEO of a startup versus coming from corporate America. And my two other companies that I was involved in, I wasn't the founder. So this is actually the first time that I've been the founder of a company that I've run. Looking forward to talking more about it.
So I'm Donna Wells. I'm CEO of Mindflash, which is a cloud-based online training platform that allows small and medium-sized businesses to get their training content up quickly and easily on the web, distributed to their employees or their customers, their partners, whoever they need to educate, and get a lot of feedback in terms of quizzes, surveys, and dashboard reporting. That's the pitch. I've been CEO of Mindflash for 2 years. This is my fifth startup, but my first time as a CEO. Prior to or interspersed with those five startups, I've also worked for very large companies like American Express, Expedia, Charles Schwab. So kind of a mixed bag of experience between both tech leadership as well as sort of entrepreneurship within very large companies. So thanks for coming out today.
Hi, everyone. I'm Julia Hartz. I'm the co-founder and president of Eventbrite. Eventbrite is the best way to create, share, and join events online. Hopefully, all of you have used our product this week. I am really excited to be here. This is actually have a pretty different background from my fellow panelists on my right here, because this is my first startup. So I've been running Eventbrite for about 6 years now, and we've grown to 200 Brightlings. And I'm really excited to share my experiences from, you know, I'm sort of a first timer. And so everything that I've experienced is almost at first blush. Prior to starting Eventbrite, I actually was a television executive at MTV and then at FX Networks.
Great. And I didn't introduce myself yet. I'm Courtney Boyd Myers. I'm the features editor of The Next Web, which is a global news technology blog. And as of yesterday, we're the last independently owned technology blog out there.
That's a statement.
Awesome. Morning, everyone. I'm Alexa Von Tobel. Also a little bit different than the panelists up here. First-time CEO. LearnVest is now the leading personal finance site where you can get financial planning. I started the company at a Harvard Business School because I felt like I personally wanted to find a place online where I could get a financial plan and really access an expert that's unbiased. So LearnVest has raised $25 million in the last 24 months, so I haven't slept in 24 months, which is a true story. We provide content tools. You can link all your accounts to LearnVest. And then we have a large team of certified financial planners that if you want help, you can actually pay to upgrade, and they'll review what's happening with your financial life and give you a 5-year plan. We're trying to disrupt this pretty, what I would say is a pretty fairly boring space, which is personal finance, and making it as modern and consumable as, you know, the Apple's Genius Bar, where we all have questions about our money. It shouldn't be hard or it shouldn't be inaccessible. A financial plan isn't a luxury, and it should be accessible to everyone here in America. So we're in New York City. We're 50 full-time people, growing to about 100. We have some pretty exciting years ahead of us, and I hope you guys all check out LearnVest.
Awesome. So we obviously have an amazing panel up here, women from just so many different trails that they've blazed to get to where they are today. We all talked on the phone before we got to Austin, and I kind of grappled with this idea of the word tech ed. And in a positive way, I kind of just want to talk about this word for a second and sort of, we have, you know, Alvin and the Chipmunks, and then there were like the Chimpets maybe, and like there's these sort of terms that and maybe aren't the most positive way to differentiate men and women, right? So just open question, does anyone have anything to say about the word tech ed and kind of how you feel about it and your primary visceral reaction to it?
I think it makes it sound like Barbies.
Yeah.
Internet Barbie.
Yeah.
I'm not a fan.
All right, so.
But I'm open to other points of view.
we just wanted to get that out of the way. We didn't pick that. But okay, so I guess we have three women to my right that all have families and companies. So they have like real children and then their startups who are their first babies, right? And then Alexa and I who are like living in New York and doing our thing, and we're like, how do you ever have time for that? And I just, this is the question to me that I'm like, I have so much respect for you guys, because I'm like, how do you balance it? So I guess starting with Meredith, you know, I'd love to know like how you can tell the younger women in this audience to sort of prepare for wanting to launch a company and having children and a loving husband and all those juggling balls.
And this is the first time I've ever been asked anything like this. I speak on a lot of panels, but Courtney's like, oh, you know, how do you usually respond? I'm like, I've never been asked this. First of all, I don't believe there is such a thing as work-life balance. I actually think it's a seesaw. And you're all in on work, and you're all in on family, and it's just a matter of balancing it and making sure you're not up in the air too much on one and leaving the other behind. So, you know, it's not easy, but I think you have to approach it the same. You have to approach your family the same way you approach your business in a good way, right? You have to work hard in order to have your business successful. You have to work hard to make sure you have a good family. And you have to have a great management team around you in a company. You have to have a great support infrastructure around you. And I'm not talking about hiring housekeepers and nannies, because a lot of people can't afford to do that. But it's, you know, making sure that you have backup, making sure that your spouse is either sharing in it, or in my case, my husband decided to stay home. We had horrible nanny stories, and we both looked at each other and said, this isn't working. So he's actually stepped back. But it's also more. I have like my school mom friend who keeps me in the know on what's going on the playground, so I'm not a complete idiot when I show up to the rare things that I do. And everyone says, oh, you're Miranda's mom. You know, it's like, and a friend of mine who's the CEO also said, you know, she showed up the other day to pick up her child and they thought she was the nanny. You know, they had no idea who she was. And that, you know, that's part of the lows. Like, you have to realize you're not going to be there for every school. My children are 10 and 7. So, but my daughter attended her first board meeting when she was 3 weeks old. It was a conference call. I didn't subject the board to a 3-week-old baby. But, you know, it's, you just do what you need to do. And you make sure that you aren't setting yourself to do it all yourself.
I think that, so I have a 4-year-old and an 11-week-old, and I think that I think that one of the things that Sheryl Sandberg has said that it's actually really resonated with me is that the most important career decision you'll ever make is whether or not you'll have a partner and who that partner will be. And when I first read it, I was like, she did not just say the most important career decision you'll ever make is like who you marry, right? But when I really read past what my initial perception was, it actually, I realized it's so true, because I have a partner in Kevin Hartz, who's also the co-founder and CEO of Eventbrite. But we've made the decision to go into both starting a company as well as having a family together. And we've made that decision that sort of breaks a lot of stereotypes and kind of breaks down some barriers for us, because we really are all in together. And so there's this like sense of 50-50 ownership on everything, both home and at work. And I think that really drives my ability and feeling empowered to be, you know, sort of in the middle of that seesaw. I love that analogy of the seesaw, because it really is very hard to keep it centered. But I do think that you have to choose the right people to support you and to work with you to make, you know, it all possible. You know, I think that you also have to try to find the ways in which you can work with partners. And it doesn't have to be your husband, or it doesn't have to be, you know, somebody you're related to. It's also you know, who you choose to work with and how you divide and conquer and get from point A to point B 2 times faster. So I think that's probably the most important part of how we make everything work.
Can I add one more thing, because I forgot? It's a really important thing that I wish somebody had told me. Also figure out, like, I expected I would have work really, really hard in my 20s, and then I'd start to have children in my 30s. And I found out it was going to take a long time to have kids. So you can find out in your 20s if you can have kids in your 30s, or, you know, there's stuff out there to figure that out. So a lot of people never talk about that. So I'm just going to put it out there for all you young women in your 20s, because you know, you just like you may not get funding for your company, you may not have that kid even though you've planned for it. So.
Just to weigh in without talking about kids because I don't have them. Someone said something really interesting to me the other day, which is it doesn't matter if you're running a company and a family. You know, I still have my home life, which is balancing lots of different things and my friends and my family, et cetera. When your life's this intense and when, you know, you're responsible for a lot, you have like really focused clarity on what's important and what's valuable. And so I just don't do anything that's useless. And I think it's really, it's not, I find a lot of clarity in that, which is like the things that are really critical for me to do, they get on my schedule. The things that aren't on my schedule. You know, if it's important for me to go to the gym, it's going to get on my schedule. If it's important for me to see the doctor, it's going to get on my schedule. And I think it just provides this really real focus where I don't sit around for, you know, 2 hours on a Sunday lollygagging around anymore because I'm trying to balance everything. And I do think that to some degree, it's built in focus when your life's this intense. So the most important things always end up on your schedule. And if they don't, then they probably weren't that important to you. So that helps me find some clarity.
And make no mistake about it, a startup is a child. There are so many parallels between building a startup and raising children. It's probably like once a week that I find a very strong parallel between the two experiences. So if you're thinking about starting a company, if you're starting a company, it is your own child. It's your own creation. I actually feel... I feel the same feelings about Eventbrite and the people at Eventbrite as I do about my family. And I know that's probably like a weird thing to say, and I don't know how my children will feel about it someday, but hopefully they'll be happy. They'll be running the company. So, but I feel very strongly about both, and I think that that's something you need to know going into it. You don't have children, like little people, but you have your company,
yeah,
which
for
is
sure.
Yeah, the same thing.
Donna, do you have anything?
So much good advice. The only thing I'd add to it is I also have a stay-at-home husband, which is tremendous degrees of freedom in my life. And I think most of the women CEOs I know don't have someone that's doing what they're doing. Julia and Kevin being a raging, wonderful exception to that rule. And, you know, if you look at male CEOs and their home lives, it's often the case that their partner is not working also. So just be open to that possibility as well. There are not a lot of women in the country that are organizing their families that way. I'm guessing statistically we're far out there on the outlier scale. But as far as CEOs, I think it's fairly typical, whether you're male or female.
Great. So I met with Alexa in New York, and we're talking about how she's raised $25 million in 1 year, which is like amazing. Mm-hmm. And at these women-only panels, when women are the focus in running businesses, the topic often comes up about, you know, when you were raising money, did you encounter any negative reactions to being a woman? And Alexa's answer to this was like brilliant. So I just want you to share with us your experience and sort of how you put yourself out there and how you thought about yourself.
I think in general, my whole life, I don't care what box I fit into. I don't care if I'm a woman or I'm blonde or I'm young or I'm a first-time CEO. I've always just cared about, am I going to be the smartest in the room? Am I going to have the most insight and the most knowledge? And am I going to be able to be the best at what I'm building and doing? And so my 10-second story is I dropped out of Harvard Business School in the heart of the recession to build a personal finance startup as a 25-year-old first-time CEO. And worst time in the planet to try to raise money, really, really hard. And I just always felt like all that mattered was that I know more about the space, that I know more about the problems, that I know more about the customer, that I know more about the product, and have extraordinarily clarity on all of those things. And what was pretty awesome is, you know, we raised a seed round. Sorry, we reached a Series A, and we ended up with almost 10 term sheets in 6 weeks, which doesn't typically happen. And I never had anyone care about who I was or where I came from, or all they cared about was what I thought. And I felt that was really important. And I think it's very important in general just to keep your head down and focus on being the smartest and the best at what you're doing. And don't care about all the noise, and don't care about what box you fit into. And if you're wasting time thinking about that, then you're not focusing on the things that are actually critical to your future, your business's success, and to your customer's success.
Do you guys have any sort of fundraising stories and how you kept your head down to achieve your goals that you want to share?
I think things are changing, and I think things have gotten a lot better in the last 5 years. I still think we need more women VCs out there. You know, most women are angels, and they're kind of in you know, female ghettos, you know, like all women, and the best way to make change is to really get into the mainstream and get into the VC space. So I see that changing. I think that there's a big difference if your company has something that's gender specific, and none of my companies have. You know, my companies have been all technology based that have been, you know, real time streaming or now mobile messaging platforms, right? And so you're not getting, I'm not getting access to the women angels and the women, like they're, those investors are looking for female oriented companies. So I haven't had nightmare experiences, but, you know, you're definitely looked at differently. You know, I've had in the past one of my companies, I was pregnant and I didn't want to tell my board. I actually hid it from them because I didn't want to add that to the dynamic. I just wanted to make it all business. And this was only 6 years ago. So the good news is I got really fat when I was pregnant, so I hid it for a long time. And I remember just sitting in a board meeting, I'm like, oh, by the way, I want to let you know I'm 7 months pregnant, and so I'll be taking you know, 2 weeks maternity leave, right? But, you know, so there's definitely, you know, I think Alexis had a great experience, and I think that that is much more of the future and that things are changing.
I don't have any nightmare stories, I'm happy to say, to share. But I do think, to Meredith's point, it is statistically proven that at least the Sand Hill Road VCs, I assume it's true of New York as well, they're 75% more likely to fund a female CEO, female founder startup if they have at least one female VC partner. So if I were going to go the traditional VC route, I would definitely go shopping for looking through that partner list and find the ones that have women on it, because I'm a big fan of statistics and why fight the reality as opposed to going with it. Fundraising is hard enough. So give yourself every advantage you can to begin with.
True I that.
Sorry?
Fundraising is hard enough.
Yeah, hard enough. It's hard enough, exactly. The other thing I'd say is I see an awful lot of female founders, female CEOs, going non-traditional funding routes. So to your point, angel investors, either male or female, are just bootstrapping their business. It's so cheap to run a company now. And if you can avoid the fundraising and manage to get your business built, on the cheap, then why not do it? You don't have the dilution, you don't have the fundraising distraction from running your business, and yeah, if you can, do. I see a lot of women just avoiding the whole VC scene entirely.
So we bootstrapped Eventbrite for the first 2 years and raised some angel funding the third year, and then the fourth year was really when we decided to go out and raise an official round from a real VC, because we knew where we wanted to go with our product and we needed some money to get there, and we knew exactly where we wanted the endpoint to be. And so we went out and met with the VC community, and we were a husband and wife team. So, you know, of course that came up in the room as a question. And we had a really honest answer, and we just sort of hit it head on. We didn't try to talk around it or make excuses. There should be no excuses for you deciding who your partner is going to be or who you are. And so we talked a lot about sort of our roles within the company, what we expected our roles to be, because at that point we were 30 people and now we're 200. And so we raised a round from Sequoia Capital in 2009, and then went on to raise two more growth rounds. And we've actually raised to date $80 million. And so I think that we've had some very strong experiences with VCs, and I have actually never really felt like me being a woman made any difference. We just focused on the service we were building and the partnership that we had. So I think that I've had really positive experiences to date with VCs, and we've seen how they can actually help grow our business.
Great. Well, thank you. In the building of your business and in the continual building of your business, when you guys were seeking out mentors or when you found mentors, tell me, were they generally male or female, or, you know, tell a bit about your mentorship experience. We'll start with Donna, maybe?
No? I wish you hadn't.
Okay.
My mentors have all been men, and I reflect on that. Why is that? I don't have a great answer, but that's the reality.
Well, I mean, the space is primarily men, to be fair. It's a larger portion of men.
True, but I, you know, my career has covered both financial services, travel services, and tech. And so even so, across a range of those three industries, it's still men, guys.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I started my career at Ogilvy, which was an amazing, amazing place to start doing interactive advertising in the early days. And I was surrounded, although my immediate boss, who's my biggest mentor, Martin Nissenholtz, you know, was a man, I was surrounded by VPs, SVPs, the CEO of Ogilvy Direct, Shelley Lazarus. So I always had that feeling of, okay, women can do it all, can live at the top. But I, too, like Donna, didn't really have a mentor back then. I mean, other than Martin, I didn't have a mentor. And then I moved into the world of telecom where there were no women around. So, you know, I think I too have some great mentors, but they're all men.
I think that in the Valley, there's a lot of, we have sort of an embarrassment of riches in many different ways. So especially in San Francisco now, there's just this vibrant, vibrant community. And so I've actually found several female startup, you know, entrepreneurs who have provided mentorship to me in different ways and, you know, of how to balance life and how to really deal with growing a big team. And then I find mentorship in all different parts of my life. So not just in the tech world or in the business world, but really about, you know, like my mother's a mentor, what kind of mother do I want to be? And also with my peers. So Eventbrite is an incredibly balanced company. We actually, out of the 200, there's 84 females. I just did a count. And you know, our executive team is actually 6 women and 2 males. So I find a ton of sort of like-minded peers, mentorship happening every day, you know, with our VP of marketing here, Tamara, to, you know, everybody in the company that I feel like I can connect to and really share ideas with. So the idea of mentorship, there's so many different ways that you can find mentors. And I guess that instead of focusing on whether or not they're female or male, you kind of want to look at where their domain expertise is and what you can learn from them. And so I guess the bottom line is I find mentors every day in different areas of my life. And some of them are male and a lot of them are female.
I was just going to add something totally separate than this, but the way I always think about mentorship is, let's say you have to climb Kilimanjaro tomorrow. What's the fastest way to figure out how to do it is to go find someone who climbed Kilimanjaro, ask them what they packed, what time of season they went, who they brought with them, you know, what their their blind spots were. So for me, I don't care about anything. I don't care how old they are. All I care is, like, whenever I'm looking for a mentor, have they climbed Kilimanjaro the best, and then ask them how they got there. And I always think about complete skill set, and that's all I care about. And in fact, we just hired someone at LearnBest who didn't go to college at all, didn't maybe even necessarily graduate from high school, but this person's skills were incredible. And I was like, that's all I care about. And I think that just in general, I only think about skill set when I'm looking for anything, whether it's an employee, a VP, a mentor, a best friend. You know, I'm always just looking at people based on just how smart and how bright and how thoughtful they are. And I don't care if they're young, old, rich, poor, what race they are, what city they live in. I just want the smartest and the brightest.
That actually segues perfectly into the next question. And of all the entrepreneurs that I've interviewed, they all say, like, one of the most important facets of growing your business is hiring excellent talent, people that are smarter than you, like the most brilliant people you can possibly find. So I just want to hear a little bit from everyone about their hiring experiences and you know, from there. So you kind of, if you have anything else to add,
sure.
Go for it.
Well, I think what makes a really great office isn't like, oh, we provide coffee and there's like really great chips in the back. I think what makes an awesome office is if you work with stunning colleagues, if you really work with people that you learn from, you want to talk to, you're fascinated by. And so what I always try to do is hire the best for whichever role we're trying to do. And, you know, if they have whatever interesting complications, if they're in different cities, I'm like, you know what, I don't care about that. All I care about is that you're the best suited for this role. And what happens is you end up creating really great culture because people are so inspired by the people that they work with. They want to go for coffee. They want to learn from them. And then what we do is we break down, and on Fridays, you know, we try to have these lunch and learns where people can share. And it can be anything. You know, we're doing a flower mixing lunch and learn where you learn how to, you know, pop flowers. And then we're having someone else bring in their camera and talk about photography. But it's because people want to learn from each other. So again, skill sets, and the best culture you can create is a smart culture where people love their fellow colleagues because they're so smart.
We've really built our team from, you know, we were 30 back in 2010 and now, you know, 200. We've really built that team from internal referrals. I mean, that's our biggest source of candidates and successful hires. And I think that that shows that we've been able to scale our culture. We have a pretty strong culture. And I think that that goes back to when we raised our first round from Sequoia and we knew that we were going to be growing from 30 to 100. And that was a big year for us because I felt like 100 was a huge company. And there was just like, you know, all these things that could happen with 100 people. And you could turn into this bureaucratic company where you had no culture, no backbone, no substance. And so that's really when we decided to, or at least I decided to spend a lot of my time focusing on how we grew the team and what kind of team we would be. And, you know, I'm happy to say that we're this incredible sort of mini society now where we have, you know, 200 really bright, unique, dynamic Brightlings that I'm just thrilled to go to work with every day. And I think that what Alexa said is true. You want to find people who are going to inspire others. And that's what we've done. We found people who are passionate about their area of the business, and they want to actually learn more about the other areas of the business. So there's this collaborative culture that's really sort of you know, gathered momentum as we've actually added more people. So one of the biggest misconceptions that I've had is that if you grow a team really fast, it'll lose its sort of color and its texture, and that's actually completely not true. Now, I've learned that as you grow a team, if you're thoughtful about it, I think of it as sort of a quilt. It takes on a lot of different colors and textures, and it becomes more vibrant. And so I would say that's probably one of the most important lessons I've learned in growing a team for the first time.
So to segue on that, I remember this. Somebody posed this riddle to me. So you're interviewing two candidates. One is brilliant, absolutely, you know, knows his knowledge area or her knowledge area in depth, would be a great addition to the experience of the team, but doesn't have the right fit. And then you have another candidate who is absolutely in line with your culture, you know, epitomizes your goals, your mission statement, would just be fantastic for your culture, but isn't quite up to speed in terms of the level of intelligence that you're looking for. Which do you hire? And the answer is neither. You need to get both. You need to get someone with that cultural fit, and you need to get the brilliance and build a team. If you hire giants, you'll have a team of giants around you. The thing that I find the hardest, though, is as in any fast growth company, your needs change, and the person that you hired who is fantastic at an early stage may not be the right person on a later stage. And that's where I think women CEOs are different, because I've made it a really important goal to treat people well and to tell them, listen, you need to stretch to this, or the world is changing here. And what, you know, you were a generalist before, we need specialists. And sometimes people can't make that leap. You know, you arm them with a training, you try and get them there, but sometimes they don't make that leap. And so when I've had the luxury and companies that had the funding, I've, you know, given them long runways, go find that job, sure, be a part-time consultant for us, use your office. But, you know, I think it's important to treat people well, and you know, it's not just the hiring, but it's also, you know, you're going to be running into this if you're a high growth company. You know, your staffing needs are going to change, and that's one of the hardest things that you face.
Yeah, you want anyone that leaves the company to be as much an advocate for you.
Absolutely.
An evangelist, especially if you're a small company, you just don't have that many voices out there. And you can't afford to have any one of them being negative, right, about the organization. You know, I think hiring from referrals, absolutely a best tactic, best strategy. You know, we all talk about hiring the absolute best and the brightest, and I feel the same way. But very few people have taken the time to try to translate how that actually happens. You know, how do you find A players? How do you interview A players? How do you know you've got one in front of you when he or she is there? And I recommend to you guys Oren Hoffman, who's CEO of Rapleaf, has actually written a couple of interesting presentations, given some good talks specifically on identifying and recruiting A players. And if you get a chance to check it out, it's sort of a little primer on how to get that done. We're at a crossroads right now. Actually, we have a very strong culture, and I'm proud to say we've actually recruited people into the company that had offers from other sexier, big brand name Silicon Valley companies, specifically because they said the culture that we had going at Mindflash was one that just tipped the balance in favor of coming to work for us instead of others. So it can be a real competitive asset. But we're at a crossroads right now in that one of our earliest employees, our senior dev, our scrum master, is going to be moving to Vermont. Which is his home. He's going to move back east with his wife and I think probably start a family. This is recorded, right? John,
yeah.
John and Mona, you're now outed. You're having children. it's going to kill me.
But, she doesn't know yet.
yeah, 7 months in hiding it. Where was I going with that? Oh, and that's a big moment for our company. He's really a core part of our culture. So how do we manage to maintain our culture when he's going to be 3,000 miles away? Doing the same job, we're a company that's sort of half local, half remote, so we know how to work remote. But he's such a core part of our spirit as a company. It's going to be a real effort and going to take some investment on all of our time to make sure that we maintain the culture even as we work through this transition.
A lot of Google Hangouts.
Yeah, there's not a remote tool that we don't use, I tell you. And they all have their role to play. So, yeah, that helps a lot. I don't know if we could have done it 5 or 6 years ago before some of these tools got a lot better.
I just have a quick question that I'm so super curious about. Gina Trapani put out this site last week called Narrow the Gap, and she had all of these statistics about how women are paid less than men for the same positions. And I don't usually write about gender-specific topics for the Next Web, but this one, I was feeling all riled up, so I went for it. And I went on a rant, and I gave it to my editor, Alex, and he was like, holy crap, you cannot publish this. And he Skyped me, and he's like, you're going to sound like an idiot. And I was like, oh, thanks, you know? And then he said to me, the one reason, you know, you're forgetting here is that women aren't negotiating their base salaries when you hire them versus men are. And I've never really hired someone. So have you found that in your experience? Are women not negotiating for higher base salaries and men are?
No, I think it's equal opportunity. I mean, again, we're so balanced in gender. It's like almost a non-issue, but I think that when I think back on so Kevin and I interview every single person who joins the company, and so oftentimes we're involved in the offer negotiation, and I'm thinking back on like, you know, a few of the offers that we've made recently in the negotiations that have happened, and I think that I'm seeing negotiations on equally on either side of the coin.
Great.
So as a personal finance expert and founder of a personal finance website, it's incredible. So every single person I expect to negotiate their salary. And in fact, we publish stories, you know, 50 stories a week, and often they're around how to negotiate. And so I actually teach the people that I hire basically how to negotiate.
How does that work?
Yeah, how does that work? Well, no, I always respect them. And I think every single person in this room, you should go in and you should negotiate. And two quick tips, you should go and negotiate your salary. And if they can't give you your salary, ask for all the other intangibles. Can you give me more vacation? Can you do more equity? Can you give me X, Y, and Z? And I think it's really critical and you should always do it. And in fact, every single employee, I negotiate their salary with them. And if they don't, I actually pull them aside and I'm like, you know what? I respect you less. I want you to negotiate your salary with me.
There's a healthy negotiation.
Our CFO's
and then there's
in the room. He's dying right now.
There's a healthy negotiation and unhealthy negotiation,
yeah.
Though. I think that once,
yeah.
You know, one of the things I've learned along the way of hiring and that process is that the offer stage is actually part of the interview in my mind, because you're learning a lot about that person. And it's not that if they negotiate or if they ask for something you don't want to give them that you say, no, sorry, I'm rescinding the offer. It's just that you do learn a lot about people when you're in that position. And so I think that there are ways to negotiate.
Without being a jerk.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's probably on your site somewhere. I should look.
Yeah, it is. Google negotiation and learn best.
I think I thinking through recent offers, I think it's more age related than it is gender related. And by that I mean folks in their 20s are probably less likely to negotiate salary than people in their 30s and 40s and older. And I think that's lessons learned. You know, you get into a company and you realize, oh, I'm not being paid what my peers are being paid. Well, guess what? They asked for more compensation in whatever form it may come, and you didn't. And next time you're looking for a job, you're out there negotiating because you know there's usually more to be given. So I think it's just one of those lessons learned. I think also, you know, in folks, especially I assume folks in this room, very interested in passion-driven businesses. You're pursuing, you know, journalism or online applications or the personal finance space or the mobile and messaging space because it's really something you deeply care about and are excited by. And I think people then say, oh, well, I'm not in it for the money, so I'm not going to negotiate my salary. This is something I'm doing for the love of it. And my advice to you is, like, get paid what you're worth. Do something you're really passionate about, but don't shortchange all the other perks and benefits that come from knocking yourself out to make sure a product or business is successful, because money gives you degrees of freedom to do what you want to do after this gig is over. So definitely negotiate.
I'll take a slightly different tack, because I think it's initially the people that we're hiring are negotiating, and even if they're in their 20s, they're usually their mom or their dad is helping them negotiate, right? They'll come back and say, well, I talked to my dad and he said this and this, and so that's fine, great. But I see a difference in once you have an employee in a position, and I do see the women in my organization much more, like, they might see another area that they want to get involved in, but they don't really proactively come and say, hey, can I do this too? And so we've actually done that. Like, we hired a woman as a community manager and said, hey, would you like to help us out on some of the marketing stuff? And she's like, oh, I would love to. Thank you so much. You know, but she could have come and said that to us. Mm. And so I think it's more of the initiative of, particularly in a startup, you can wear lots of different hats. And we make that very clear. But I still think that there's a little bit of a hesitation of, I'm not sure if I want to go into this new area, because she didn't have any marketing background and she wasn't like any of the other people in the marketing area. But so I do see a little bit of a difference there, but I think it's just a matter of the culture that you instill in people, and so they'll get that. In my corporate world at a cable business, I was at Roadrunner, one of the early founders of the Roadrunner venture, and this woman was doing administrative work, and another administrative in another department, you know, basically requested a position. I went to this person, I said, you should be doing it. She's an EVP right now at a major cable company. And she wouldn't have done that unless somebody prompted her to do that. So
we're going to have people line up for questions on the left-hand side. And while you're coming up for questions, I want the panelists to answer three questions, and we'll go down the line. One is, what book you're either reading or recently read that you love and people in the audience should read? Number two, what your kind of most exciting moment of South by Southwest has been, whether that's crossing an app or eating fried chicken and waffles. And the third is just take a brief moment to maybe tell the audience something they should know about your company that's either coming out soon or that you're working on, or, you know, a little bit of promo. So we'll start with Meredith.
So I used to love to read, and I just got to my school mom just sent me some book requests because I don't keep up on the non-business side. But I am reading the Power of Unpopular, which Erica Napolitano was actually speaking here, and I really think she's a fantastic writer, and I love her mentality. And I just started reading that book because I got it at the bookstore. My favorite thing about South by Southwest?
Yeah, your wow moment of the weekend, if you will.
My wow moment. It was really cool watching all the bats come down the river at sunset, you know, which was somebody who's been here before was like, you've never seen the bats before? You know, we were right by the river at this hotel, and it was really cool, very Austin experience. So, I just love the whole serendipity of South by Southwest. I've had some of my best conversations with people online or on a street corner overhearing a conversation. oh, you're from Baltimore? I'm from Baltimore. I'm not from Baltimore. Somebody that we're with was. And then, well, I'm here giving sneak previews to our new app, which is called Bandwagon, without the vowels. It'll be launching on Android in a couple weeks and then iOS shortly after. And we're calling it the world's first social tributary, social media tributary. It's basically letting you take all of your social streams across YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, and create your own bandwagon. Could have one, it could have 10 feeds, and then invite your friends into a private chat experience around it, so you're all getting that content, you're all sharing it real time. So stay tuned for that. We're going to launch it within Haywire. It will promote it within Haywire, which, you know, we have over 3 million users there, so hopefully that'll help get the viral word of mouth, but you guys hopefully can help too.
First question was book.
Book, wow moment promo.
Got it. The Startup of You is the book that I'm part of the way through. Recommended highly. Reid Hoffman, founder of LinkedIn, and Ben Casnocha co-wrote the book, and it's all about treating your career just as if you were a startup company yourself. I think the wow moment so far, I'd say connecting with Eric Schoenfeld recently of TechCrunch last night, and finding out that one of the companies I'm invested in visually is on his radar screen. He was excited about getting access to the beta that they launched yesterday. Infographics tool just came out. So I was able to get the founders via text to get him an invite, and, you know, hopefully good things will come of that for the visually team. There's a little known product on the Mindflash site, and I recommend all you to it. It's called Marketplace, and it gives anyone that has specific subject matter expertise, domain expertise, your thought leader, your guru on some topic, the Mindflash Marketplace platform. Allows you to make a course out of what your area of expertise is and actually sell it. So I encourage you, if you're looking for a little bit of income on the side, want to make yourself rich and famous off of your unique expertise, check out Mindflash Marketplace. And it's actually free. We take a commission only when you sell something. So it's a good deal.
So I think that what's live on my Kindle right now is a direct reflection of my life. I'm reading Drive by Dan Pink, and then also Cinderella Ate My Daughter by Peggy Ornstein. So that's sort of the dichotomy of where I am right now. I also read a really great book for growing teams and growing executive teams, and it's called Five Dysfunctions of a Team. It sounds negative, but it's actually a really awesome book. It's a very quick read, very prescriptive. It's sort of like the Cliff Notes version, which I totally appreciated. My favorite South by moment so far, I got in late last night, so I have to make it a little bit broader than that. It's getting the updates from Mitch Colleran, who's in the back there, on how many events have been published on Eventbrite for South by Southwest, or maybe you can shout out the number, the latest number. So 580 events, which is really exciting. And finally, my plug. So I think that what we're focusing on at Eventbrite right now is how do we redefine the experience of discovering and attending live experiences together. And so what we're working on is how do we make that experience much better for ticket buyers, for you, for people who attend events. I think everybody attends events. Everybody enjoys live experiences and being in the room together. And so how do we make that a better experience for you, and how do we allow you greater access to discovering new events that are relevant, hyper-relevant to you? So that's what you should be looking forward to.
So doing this fast, you guys have time for question. 7 effective qualities of a leader. It's about just being a good person. Fantastic psychology book. I love Steve Blank. He's been my wow moment here. Professor at Stanford Business School, just talked about great stuff for startups. And I think sort of my special thing for LearnVest, so we just launched financial planning. You can get a 5-year financial plan directly from a certified financial planner on LearnVest staff. I'm, of course, a financial expert, but I went through and got a plan myself. It's one of the best products. It really did change my life to know every question I've ever had about money answered by an expert. And my team will kill me, but if you use the promo code ALEXA50, it'll give you 50% off. And that's my personal promo code. So, yeah, check it out.
All right, great. Catherine?
Yes.
Awesome.
Hi. Catherine Posey, founder of Tech by Superwomen, live in Alaska, so I really appreciate technology bridging gaps. First of all, thank you, all of you. I found this session very inspiring. It's so great to see these strong women up there talking about women ascending into powerful positions. So I run a blog, Tech by Superwomen, and I had a panel on Saturday, and we talked about mentorship and what does mentorship do to get more women in your positions exactly. But one of the things that my blog's starting to shift to focus on is you look at Fast Company, and they talk about the four-year career, and they talk about generation flux, and it seems to me you have to know how to reinvent yourself. So I'd love to know your thoughts about reinvention and how that has worked for you, having to reinvent yourselves.
So I went from like really great sort of worker bee. I was a really good executive at a corporation. I did that really well. I was able to do all the steps to get up the ladder and whatnot. And so when I started Eventbrite, I was completely out of my realm. I was not I had not dreamt about being an entrepreneur. I didn't have my own lemonade stand. I was so it was a very new experience for me. And I think that the way in which you have to reinvent yourself is always be open to learning new lessons. And I think that you can never. I never feel like I'm the expert on anything. Scratch that. I feel like I'm the expert on Eventbrite, obviously, because I've been there since the beginning. I know it through and through. But I also feel like there are so many different facets of the business that I can learn from others that you just have. It's sort of. I guess it sort of takes humility to keep reinventing yourself because you have to be open to learning new lessons and knowing that you don't know everything, no matter what position you're in.
Hi. Thanks for the great talk. I run a company. I have a 35 people studio in Seoul making mobile games. I'd like to ask each of you, what has been the most effective carrot and most effective stick when you grew your company? And I'm especially curious on what failures you've had in employing sticks, and if you could share some of your lessons, that'd be really great. Thank you.
So I can dive in on the carrot. I think recognition is huge. Recognition within the company, recognition externally. We are putting our developers' names and giving them credit in the apps, and really trying to get them as spokespeople. For the company, they typically you wouldn't typically do that. It's all about recognition of great work, and we don't take that lightly. And we do little things and big things, right? And just $25 gift cards at our every other week lunch to award somebody for going above and beyond, or doing something completely unexpected and out of the box in an area that you wouldn't expect it from. So I think it's not really the money; it's the recognition and the ability to say that you did something and you did it well, and that everyone understands that you did it well. The stick one, I don't know.
Our carrot and our stick are actually the same thing. So when people join Eventbrite, they join with the hope of transforming an industry. So disrupting an industry, transforming, however you want to say it. We can actually make a difference in the way that people gather around live experiences. The stick is that we can be the company that nobody can really remember 5 years from now that seemed to have made some progress, but kind of fizzled out and somebody else came along and did a better job. So I think that's that like edge that you have when you're at a startup, is that you feel like there's this huge potential to make a difference and have all this glory. And then there's also like this danger of sort of, it sort of feels like it's ours to lose kind of thing. So I think that's what drives our team, in both ways.
Great.
I'm Lisa Macells. I'm a one-person marketing department at a software startup here in Austin. And before that, I started there recently after their IPO of a similar B2B software company from Austin. So I feel like I'm kind of on the beginning of your kind of career path, where you had a lot of different experiences and kind of climbed up and were CEO at maybe companies that weren't yours. Can you talk a little bit more about your career path, aside from just the awesome brilliance and creativity of founding something?
You want to go, John?
Sure. Well, I was very fortunate in retrospect to have joined the financial services industry and then the travel industry, because they were two of the very first industries to go digital and go online. When you think about it, financial services are largely commodities, travel services, you know, a plane ticket is a plane ticket is a plane ticket. So I was in industries that were early and experimental on the web, and that gave me sort of an easier entree to the world of tech, and I just found I had a lot of personal passion for it and eventually made the shift from sort of offline financial services to online financial services to online now services of any nature. So I guess the lesson there is choose your industry wisely, although there's no industry that isn't tech-enabled now, and thank God for that.
So I learned from my sister just to, because she was at ESPN when it was a trailer in Connecticut. So I got into the funky group at Ogilvy and became the youngest VP at 24. I used to wear my hair up and glasses to look old because I had all these people that later told me they couldn't believe, you know, this 24-year-old was telling them what to do. But then I was a VP and got into Roadrunner. And then decided to make the cut into software startups. I was the COO. And during some troubled times, they got rid of the CEO and promoted me. And so I was basically put in to fix things. And then my second company, I was brought in to turn things around. And I do think that's like something that's always bugged me a little bit. Like when you're talking to VCs, they're always like, oh, you're the female CEO, you're the founder. And before, I wasn't the founder. I'd be like, no, I was brought into these companies to turn them around. And look at Sheryl Sandberg, not to turn it around, but just to grow it, right? Look at Meg Whitman. I mean, there are examples of women that are coming into companies and really skyrocketing those companies. And I think that everyone should be more cognizant of that. And I'd love to see more of that publicized. But anyway.
Hi, quick question regarding the baby steps that you can take, the little daily steps of leadership when you have your first position where you're a little higher than other people and you get to delegate. What recommendations do you have to eventually get up to where you are so that we can make the most of our leadership positions?
I think leadership can come in many different forms, and I think that you know, when you're thrown into a position of leadership and you have never been a leader before, I think it's really important to find mentors that you think are great leaders and find out, you know, think about the qualities that you really admire in them and why people like to work for them. I think that one of the first things that you can do as a new leader is to find out what your team aspires to be and how, and individually and then as a team, and understand how you can start removing barriers for them and start helping them become who they want to be. I think when you become a leader, I think you become a coach. And oftentimes people are put in leadership positions too early because a lot of that coaching position is to actually put others before yourself. So if you're not at a place where you want to be yet in your career, I would almost say, you know, be brave enough to stay on that like individual contributor route and learn more about your trade than get kind of pushed into a leadership position.
Hi, I'm Marissa Lehrer, and a little too short for this microphone. And I'm a freelance web developer, and I came here on the startup bus. I don't know if you know about that. I was one of eight women on the New York bus. So
congrats.
Thanks. I'm exhausted. But, you know, the whole experience is very energizing and very exciting, and I'm like, oh, now I want to do this. I want to create another startup or whatever, but I have no idea kind of where to begin. I feel a little bit lost. And so I was wondering if you just had any recommendations on like what the hell to start with, you know?
I think finding the right partner is key. I think that no company was ever created just from one single person's thought. I think that it's about collaboration, about being able to at least bounce your ideas off somebody else, but also finding somebody who has complementary skills and who has maybe things that can add to your expertise and start brainstorming together and start thinking about ideas. I mean, we were in a space in San Francisco that was about 10 startups in one office space. So it was Eventbrite, Flixster, TripIt, Zynga had a desk there randomly. And it was all, when I think back at it, on it, it wasn't just single person founders. It was at least a partnership, if not a trio, of people who came up with these really brilliant ideas.
Hi, I'm Ronnie. We're two women founders of a social brand advocacy platform called BrandsForce. We're doing pretty well, but what we find after running for a year and a half is that, well, while more men than women that start, you know, their own idea, they have men, more of them are technologists. So they have an idea, they go to the basement, they start coding. We come from corporate backgrounds of advertising and products. We have this big vision. There's a gap there. We keep running forward, and those technology people tell us, stop selling, stop adding features. We have a gap there because we have issues hiring there and also really understanding what's going on there. And I'm wondering if you have any advice.
I think you need a CTO, co-founder-like status person to help you, because you need somebody who's going to partner with you, and it sounds like it's an unequal, right? They're working for you, but they don't respect you because you don't understand technology. So my co-founder in this venture is, you know, CTO, and you know, Mr. Brainiac, and our chief product officer is also, you know, I think the three of us actually are a really complementary team. So you need to get a senior person that's going to take ownership and be, you know, almost equal to you.
Hi. Thanks for coming. I'm really glad I came to this panel, and those two questions were actually really great segues into my question. I started an agency almost a year ago, and so everything's a first time for me as well. I come from an advertising background, and as I think about hiring on, I'm wondering, I guess, and we go back to the salaries that we want to offer those people, I come at it with an attitude that I want to offer these people a fair and honest, you know, price for their worth. So I guess when I heard you guys say always expect negotiations, should I, before I make an offer, assume that there will be negotiations and start lower because I am a startup and I do care about every single dollar? And then also, I would love to see a startup that would be like Match.com, where I could just find an employee that's perfect for my agency. So that would be a great startup.
Awesome. I think that you, I think you're thinking about it the right way and having a philosophy from the get-go. So I think it's, first and foremost, really important for you to understand what your philosophy is going to be. How are you going to pay people? Where are you going to sit within the market? And stick to that. So at Eventbrite, we want to pay everybody a competitive salary. We're in SoMa in San Francisco. You can't get more competitive than that right now. We want to pay a competitive salary that we feel is reasonable, but, you know, something that is going to, you know, at the end of the day, make everyone happy, right? But we also understand in the negotiation process or in that offer process that where our upper limit is, right? So we always have that conversation internally before we go and make the offer. So it's not this last minute sort of Harry Carey, we got to like throw everything in the kitchen sink. It's like we understand where our limit is, and then we stick to our philosophy, which has always, always, always turned out well for us.
So we've got 2 minutes and three questions. That's 40 seconds each.
Try to go fast. And I have to apologize right away. I saw an article a long time ago, and I can't remember where the article is or who wrote it or who did the study. But the study basically showed risk for women is much more risky than it is for men, meaning if men take a risk in their job, they typically, if it turns out bad, it's not a big deal. That's, better luck next time. If women take the risk and it turns out bad, they lose their job. They damage their career. It's much more detrimental to the women than the men. It's not shrugged off as well. And I'm not for sure if that comes from the women's attitude of not being able to shrug it off, or if it comes from society still not being able to, you know, you guys taking risks, and it sounds like you had a lot of risk earlier in your career with turning companies around. How did you deal with the risk, and if something failed, how did you recover?
So luckily, I turned around both of those companies. you know, I think that you just have to... I always am attracted to what gets me excited, and I like challenges. I've been on the leading edge of technology before, and... you know, if the fit's there, even if it's a risky proposition, as long as you know that that's what's you're not going in to, you know, grow this company that's well-funded. The investors were up front. They said, listen, we need you to figure out, are we shutting this down or are we turning it around? And so, I look at that as there's risk in business and men get affected equally. I mean, I'm not sure I agree with that study.
Next.
My name is Alice Kwan. I share a lot of similar stories as I hear about you chat, sharing about sort of being a part of that corporate America as an executive. I work for Walmart.com in San Francisco, and similar to the risk question, I'm actually curious, what was the tipping point in your career where you decided to take the plunge and go from sort of the Fortune 500 safety net of having a paycheck? I also have a stay-at-home husband, and so the idea of kind of going into this entrepreneurial space where I have that bug and I have that desire, but I'm also, you know, fear the risk of, you know, well, if it doesn't work out, how is that all going to work out? So I'm just curious, what was the psychology in your head as you kind of flipped from that safety net into sort of a more riskier, yet also probably more rewarding space?
Eternal optimism really was where it came from, not on my part, actually. I'm sort of the realist. My husband and co-founder, Kevin, is a serial entrepreneur. And so I think in order to be a serial entrepreneur, you have to have internal optimism and you have to be a little bit crazy. And so I think that rubbed off on me, and he sort of held out his hand and said, take the leap. And for some reason I believed him. And so I'm obviously thrilled that I did. But I think you have to have this optimism that things can work out and that you can capture the moon.
Yeah.
And I think you'll know it when you see it, which is if there's a product idea that you have, you become aware of that somebody else has got a company or a product available, and your thought process now becomes, oh my God, I'm so excited about this. I have to get in on this because it's going to be huge. And I will kick myself for years if I don't take the plunge on this now. When that becomes your inner dialogue and it gets away from, but what if it fails and I don't have a paycheck and how's the family going to put food on the table? If that's your internal dialogue, it's not the right thing for you. And there may never be a right thing for you. Startup life is not for everybody, clearly. But I think when the scripting shifts, then it's probably the right time.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Joy. And first of all, thank you so much for coming, for being so open, for giving a lot of answers that provided insights to me and I think to everyone else in this room. So quick background, was actually reading the startup of you 2 weeks ago within a week of ending my contract at LinkedIn, decided to do this crazy thing where I was going to go to South by Southwest and run into as much tech as possible. And didn't expect that the wow moment for me at South by would actually be on the road trip that I took with a college friend who I was on this rocket where I was I feel the momentum behind me. I'm meeting all these people, magical things are happening. And along the way, that happened to her too. And now she's sort of on her own path. And so, going back to something you said about leadership, actually, I actually wanted to know if you had a story that sort of top of mind of when someone enabled you or when you enabled somebody else, or of how your company, for instance, how Eventbrite enables other people to sort of do these things that allow them to collect and go on their own personal, career rocket, risky paths.
I feel that way every day, actually. I have, again, not to harp on finding the right partner, but if you find the right partner, they're actually going to enable you to break through any sort of boundaries that you thought you had and get to a place that you never thought you'd be able to be, present. I think that it's important to have those sort of cheerleaders and those people who really believe in you in your corner when you're about to embark on something as crazy as starting a company. And I think you definitely keep those people around, not just to make you feel good, but to help you feel like you have, the strength to actually sort of spread yourself out beyond your wildest dreams when you're starting a company.
So then would you say to give somebody else that would actually be to give them a person in some ways?
No, I mean, I think that you can find that from many different places. But I think that it has to be honest and true. It can't just be somebody trying to make you feel great about yourself, and you need to really believe that person.
I think we're getting kicked out of here, but we'll be in the hallway, and we'll chat there. We'll continue the conversation. So thank you so much.